RDI Insights, Mike Dempsey in conversation with Royal Designers.
Hello and welcome to RDI Insights. A rather special one for me because this will be the 50th interview I've clocked up since starting these podcasts back in 2006. Once again, we're in lockdown due to the pandemic, so I'm separated by my guest today by 150 miles. It's at times like these that we need someone to lighten our day and lift our spirits. And that's exactly what my guest today does. He is the illustrator and author, Tom Gould. For the last two decades, with his idiosyncratic books and regular appearances in The Guardian and New Scientist, Tom has been charming us with his subtle, deadpan humour, be it from the Department of Mind-Blowing Theories, Baking with Kafka, or his many strips, often inspired by the modernity of everyday life. His work is poles apart from the slashing pens of the political cartoonist, and his recognisable penmanship regularly graces the covers of The New Yorker and The New York Times. 2021 will see the publication of Tom's first children's book, The Little Wooden Robot and The Log Princess. We started our conversation by talking about the number of books he has produced.
Since you left the Royal College of Art and started freelancing, I think back in 2001, would that be?
That's correct.
Yeah. Yep. I was going through all of your publications, and you've had a book published virtually every year, with the exception of 2011 and 2014. Maybe you were doing other things then. And your latest book, The Little Wooden Robot and The Log Princess, is going to be out, I think, early next year. And in between all that, you did a US promotion tour with Baking with Kafka, which I'm sure must have been fun and exhausting. But then you have your, if you like, your everyday regular jobs, the Guardian, the New Scientist, and a long list of pretty international clients like the New York Times and the New Yorker and others. So it sounds to me like you just don't stop.
Well, I guess I do stop. I don't work weekends generally, and I don't work that late into the night actually. But when I am working, I guess I'm quite quick. A lot of my cartoons they're not meant to be like reading War and Peace. They're a momentary piece of entertainment for somebody reading. You know, you're reading the serious articles in The Guardian or The New Scientist, and I guess I'm not like this little tasty treat which is in there. So even though I do work carefully on those cartoons, they hopefully come together in over the space of a day's thinking, really. So I'm able to make quite a lot of them for that reason.
With your books, the books that you've produced over that, you know, pretty long, nearly 20-year period. Yeah. You've designed them all, I take it. I mean, obviously the content, but I'm wondering whether the covers, the typography, the whole thing is under your control. Would that be true?
Yes. I mean, those things are all really important to me.
Of course.
When I was studying at the Royal College of Art, the course was the kind of combined illustration and graphics course. So yeah. I had a lot of good friends who were book designers. And I handmade books there and did workshops with the designers. And the idea of one of my books, the story not just being contained within the book, but sort of beginning as soon as you see the cover and making all those design choices help tell the story, help set you up to enjoy the cartoons in the right way, is something that really interests me.
I mean, you've actually created... with most of your books, I think some of the later ones, not so much, but the small square format books, you've got your own little panel that sits comfortably in the centre with your image around the outside. And I think the later ones are fully bled covers. The reason I'm interested is that one of the disappointing things I've always found with the work of illustrators, and I'm talking about really great illustrators, their work leaves their hands and then other people, you know, invade them, as far as I'm concerned.
Right.
And so if you have no sensitivity with typography or understanding as what the illustrator has actually produced, you end up degrading the work. And I just wondered how much control you had over your work when it leaves you that is not, you know, in your own little domain?
Well, I have opinions, but I don't have the skills to undertake proper design myself. I can't use any of the design programs, so I'm always relying on a designer to help me make what I want to achieve. I guess I've always been lucky with the publishers that they are on board with me expressing myself on the cover as well as on the inside of the book. And there is a bit of back and forth, and I have had ideas which the publishers have pushed in one way or another, I guess, for commercial purposes. But no, I've been quite lucky with that.
Yeah.
Although it is actually very hard. I think it's doing a cover for one of my own books is harder than when I'm hired to do a cover for somebody else's book. I think because I'm so tied up in what's going on inside the book, it's difficult to distill that sometimes into a cover which sells it in that slightly, what's the word I'm looking for, in the way you need to distill it in order to sell the book. It can be trickier with your own material.
Are there areas that you just would not work in? I mean, I'm sure that you're very sought after, so you have that possibility to just pick and choose, but are there areas that you would not touch?
Do you mean morally? Or
yeah, I guess morally and or just something you particularly loathe.
I guess it gets easier to have those morals when you have a certain amount of success and are getting offered enough work. And I'm certainly a pickier now about what I do than when I started out, when I was figuring things out and basically just living hand to mouth trying to make a living. So I do make those choices and I try and choose. I don't want to do things. Well, no, I should explain. I started as an illustrator who made comic books in his spare time. And these days, I spend more time writing stories and making comics than I do being an illustrator. And I wouldn't want to make illustrations which, in some way, when you saw one of my cartoons or my stories, you had this bad memory of it being tied to some product or something which I personally would feel embarrassed by. So I guess I'm pickier for that reason, is I don't want to start talking about having a brand, because I think that's a bit sad when artists do that. But I don't want my illustrations to attach my stories to things which I'm not happy with.
Right. No, I understand. Well, look, what I'd like to do now is we'll leave the present and we'll roll back to the young Tom Goulden. You were born in 1976. So you're incredibly young as far as I'm concerned, in Aberdeen, Scotland, in, I understand, a fairly quiet rural area.
That's right, yes.
Can you sort of paint a picture of your childhood?
Yes. Well, the area I grew up in was called Woodlands of Durris. Ooh. And the name pretty much described it. It was farmland, but there was a great deal of forestry around there. And the two houses I lived in there, both backed onto fields, which when you scampered across them, you ended up in the woods. So I think you might look at my work now and imagine I was a little nerd stuck inside reading all day. And probably half the time I was, but the other half I was scampering around with other kids from the village in the woods and over the fields. So I guess I had this sort of mixture of being quite a bookish child who went to the library every week and came home with a stack of books, and living in the countryside miles from anywhere and being quite outdoorsy, really.
And do you have any siblings?
I have one younger brother who wasn't interested in artistic things, and that was a kind of sense of tension in our childhood, is I often wanted to sit quietly and draw in my bedroom and he wanted to play football. So we've kind of got over that now, but that was a kind of constant tension.
And what about your parents? What sort of era did they work in?
Well, I think for somebody who grew up as a cartoonist, I had a kind of good start there from my parents. My dad was an architect. I saw an adult who drew pictures for a living, and who had pens and a desk and, you know, lovely rulers and those, whatever, you rotring pens that you had to hold upright to draw with,
absolutely,
which I was never allowed to use in case I bent the kind of needle-like nib on it.
That's interesting, because your father being an architect would mean that you saw some pretty accurate drawings, very detailed probably, that probably must have filtered through to you in terms of, you know, some of the more elaborate things you do, which you're so good at, you know, these taking these highly complex situations and put them into little compartments and making them all fit together in a kind of Heath Robinson way. I wonder whether looking at your dad's work just sort of soaked through and registered with you.
Yes, I think it did. And I think I looked at his life and I saw him drawing at his desk, and that seemed like heaven to me. And then some days he'd drive out in his Land Rover and I'd go with him, and he'd go to a building site and have an argument with the builder, and that side of it seemed like hell to me. So I think I sort of took the quietly sitting at the desk element and made that into my whole job.
So when did the drawing start? Very early on in your life?
Yes, very early. I always drew, and I've always got pleasure out of drawing and can do it almost as a sort of fiddle to pass the time as much as making any art. Although as a kid I also enjoyed the ego boost of making pictures that people enjoyed.
And did you use your drawing skills as a form of conversation?
I'm not sure when I was a child there was a lot of lying behind the sofa and drawing while other things were going on, so almost the opposite. As a teenager and a young teenager I did draw a lot of, all the cartoons I drew were to amuse friends or for that reason. So it did become a sort of a way of amusing people and getting attention in my teenage years.
That's very interesting, because I think when you're at school, there are two types of people that can kind of get away with virtually everyone. One is somebody that's funny. Everybody likes somebody that's funny. Mm-hmm. And the other is someone that can draw, because often people around you just can't do it. Doesn't matter how much they try, they can't. But if you've got a natural ability, then I'll give you an example. When I was at school, which is a long time ago, back in the 50s, I went to a pretty rough school where all the kids wanted to do is make rings in the metalwork department with spikes on them for fighting. And they were pretty rough, you know, lots of fights. But I could draw, and I had one of those pens with three colours, you know, the biros, blue, red, and anyway, I would do all the tattoos because they wanted tattoos, you see.
Okay.
So I would do little swallows, you know, on their thumbs, and so I would be completely protected by these people. I could just kind of blend in with them because, like you, all I wanted to do was draw because I was pretty useless at anything else. How were you academically at school?
I wasn't bad. In my primary school, I was very lucky. I was always drawing in the margins of my notebooks. Uh-huh. And my teacher said to me, it's silly filling up the margins of the notebooks because they have a purpose. I'll give you your own notebook that you can draw in. And as long as you get the work finished, you can draw as much as you want all day long. So I'd always have two books open in front of me. And in one of them, I'd be doing the maths or whatever. And when I was done, instead of just waiting for the next thing, I was off to the second book. So I was very lucky that Mrs. Horrocks saw that in me and gave me an extra book and understood that somehow doodling didn't actually stop me getting things done.
Oh, so you had a Mrs. Horrocks. That's great, because, you know, I wondered where, you know, you have to think back and think, well, who encouraged me on this journey? And often it's a teacher. A teacher that could see something in you, and that's rather a nice gesture to give you an extra exercise book to draw in. I guess, you know, I can remember certainly at school, and I'm sure many, you know, drawing with biro all over the exercise book covers. You know,
yes.
That was one of the pastimes. Everybody would do that.
And you could get a lovely sort of soft line with a biro if you did it right. And then every now and then it would go wrong and you get a horrible blob that would appear and it would kind of ruin some sort of elegant drawing I'd been working on. I remember being happy when I moved on from drawing with biros for that reason.
Did you keep any of those early exercise books?
I do. My mum may have kept them. I mean, my mother was a teacher, and I think for that reason was a very good at encouraging both me and my brother to do the things we like to do. So she definitely encouraged me and held on to a lot of the books. And I imagine some of them must be stored away somewhere, but I haven't looked at them for years.
So when did it occur to you that this might be a potential life for you, the idea of going to art school? Presumably you went to some sort of foundation course first.
Well, actually, in Scotland, you tend not to have a foundation course because in Scotland, degrees are were traditionally 4 years.
Oh,
they kind of roll the foundation in. So if you go to art school in Scotland, or at least when I was there, you do a 4 year course. At the end of the first year, people change colleges sometimes, and a lot of English students arrive. But not having lived outside Scotland and not really understanding the world outside, I never really thought of foundation. So it was I applied to Edinburgh and Glasgow to do a 4 year course. And what I liked about Edinburgh, which is the one I chose, was you did a very general first year, very much like a foundation, and then you could specialise. Whereas I was put off Glasgow a bit because I think you had to choose between fine art and design from the beginning, which at that point I wasn't quite sure what I would do. I knew I wanted to go somewhere and I knew I wanted to draw, but I wasn't quite clear which course would be best to do that in, if you see what I mean.
I do. And how did you find the kind of experience of moving from your home to Edinburgh, which is a pretty lively place?
Well, it was all just completely exciting. I lived in the countryside. It was always about getting a lift from a parent somewhere, or when I learned to drive, borrowing a car. And living in a city and in Edinburgh, and that life, that was amazing.
Yeah.
And being at art school, and just instead of drawing, you know, instead of drawing in the art class and surreptitiously in all the other classes, it was just all day long. You can draw and make art and be surrounded by people who are interested in these same things. And I was just had the most amazing 4 years there. Just loved every minute of it, really.
Well, I think the great part about joining other creative people is that you feel suddenly you've arrived on a planet where everyone seems to understand. Whereas, you know, outside of that, it's quite difficult sometimes. People can't understand quite what it is you do. So it ups the ante, and then there's this sense of competition and, you know, crossover stuff. It's always exciting. So you were there for 4 years. That's a long time. So how did you develop over that 4 years into, you know, the direction you wanted to go into?
Well, I think that's another wonderful thing about art school, is being with people not just doing exactly the same thing as you, but all the other courses around you. So I had friends who were on the film courses, and I worked with them helping on their films and thinking about storytelling and learning about storytelling from them. And I enjoyed the printmaking classes and bookbinding classes. So I was kind of learning about publishing really there. And I did some animation classes as well. So I was trying out all these things, but I realized that illustration was the best place for me to basically draw all day long.
And what about the storytelling aspect? How did that develop? Had you always written little ditties, little stories before going to uni, or did it just sort of, had you been inspired by some people?
Well, I did do, as I was saying, silly little cartoons to amuse friends.
Yeah.
But I'd never imagined that I would have a career that involved writing. I think I when I went to art school, my feeling was I'd illustrate other people's texts.
Yes.
And because drawing was my thing and writing seemed like this impossible thing that you needed a whole separate set of skills to do. But over the course, over those 4 years, the illustration department was run by a wonderful man called Jonathan Gibbs, who, even though he wasn't a cartoonist himself, he understood those things and he encouraged me to make stories, and he showed me Edward Gorey's book. And I think those were a massive influence. Well, they were a massive influence. And I think seeing them was maybe a bit of a turning point where I realised you could tell stories with pictures and they didn't have to slot neatly into the bracket of children's book or comic book. They could be this in-between thing.
Well, I'll tell you a story about Edward Gorey.
Please do.
I worked in publishing in the 60s and 70s and a company called William Heinemann Publishers.
Right.
And I was the art director. And when Amphigory, I think is the one, the alphabet book of his. Do you know that book?
Yeah, the first collection of his short books.
Well, the British version, although it was exactly the same as the American, was published by the publishing house I was with. So, of course, I got a copy early on.
Right.
And I absolutely loved it. I took it home, and I've always read to my children, and my very youngest daughter, I started, because it was mostly pictorial, I started showing her the pictures and reading, and she became really fascinated by the kind of untimely deaths.
Yes.
And the dreadful mishaps recorded in the book, like A is for Amy who fell down the stairs, or B is for Basil assaulted by bears,
Exactly.
She'd want to go through everyone in detail. And I thought, am I damaging my daughters? But I immediately, when I saw your work, although your style is completely different, you have that same ability to create a kind of stillness in your work. There's a kind of, I don't know what it is, it's a sense of space and loneliness that I think is so beautiful. It's very quiet. And you feel it.
It's nice to hear you say that. And yes, it's definitely, if I hadn't seen those Edward Gorey books when I was at that age, finding my style, and I certainly in the past did stuff which was a lot more influenced by him.
Yes.
But I guess like a lot of these things, I kind of digested it and kept the stuff which suited me and left alone the things which don't, and ended up taking what I needed from his work.
I think it's that old adage that some actor said to another actor when he said, how can I become a great actor? And he said, just copy, dear boy, and make it your own. And I think there's a lot in that people are inspired by, whether it's an artist or actor or whatever, and suddenly it becomes you, and it's quite different. You've actually learned something from them. So I think good examples of the kind of isolation and kind of loneliness that are very evident are your Goliath and also Mooncop. I think those are two really good examples of that stillness that you create so well. Let's talk a little bit now about I want to go back. I want to go back to the Royal College, because that's an important stepping stone, because following on from the Edinburgh College of Arts, you obviously decided to apply to the Royal College. That's quite a big step, and presumably meant you would be moving to London.
Yes. Well, I had no particular interest in going to the Royal College of Art, and I didn't really know much about it, and I didn't have, which I think is a good thing, that some of my London educated artistic friends at art school almost had a feeling, well, it's not quite finished if you don't go on to the Royal College of Art. And whereas in Edinburgh, I was quite separate from that. And it was only towards the end of the course, the head of the course, Jonathan, just said to me, you could apply. My students do from time to time. People don't often get in, but you could give it a try. And I thought, my work is getting somewhere, but it's not quite ready yet. And another 2 years, I was just beginning to get into telling stories, and I felt like I was on the edge of coming up with some good work. And it really seemed like 2 more years somewhere would be good. So I took his advice and I applied, and surprisingly got in. And so I moved to London for that reason. And if I hadn't got in, I would perhaps still be living in Scotland now. It wasn't a great dream to come to London, but coming to the Royal College of Art was amazing. It was like that feeling of going to art school, but again, it was like on another level of commitment and camaraderie between the students there. So again, I had a wonderful 2 years exploring storytelling, really, at the Royal College.
And of course, with all those other students, the ante was upped, because so many brilliant people have attended the Royal College over the years, and I've worked with many, I know many, and it is a very special place. So that must have been terrific, just getting to know others that were doing work that you could admire, because I think that's really quite an important thing.
And it was there that I got a desk. I was assigned a desk in one of the studios there, and on the next desk to me is my great friend Simon Leah, with whom I published my first handful of comics, were done together under a little publishing company we set up ourselves. So it kind of just the thing of being in a room with someone else who's interested in some of the same things and some different things, and we introduced each other to different things and inspired each other. So kind of Simone was very important to my publishing comics, because having a friend to do it with, especially at the beginning, is a really, really helpful thing.
So tell me now about the coming towards the end of your time at the Royal College at that period. When did it sort of occur to you that actually I can make a living out of this? Because I'm sure even everyone that goes to the Royal College, they still have that anxiety. Will they be able to make enough money to be able to live in London, pay the rent, all the stuff that you've got to deal with?
Yes. And I didn't. It was, I think, leaving art school is and going out into that world you've just described is a difficult thing. And also I had to go back. I hadn't got directly into art school from school, and I'd done a sort of preparation course. So I'd been in art school for 7 years in a row when I left the Royal College of Art. So I was definitely coming from, and before that had just been at school, so coming from a coddled world of 7 years of creativity in art school into the real world of knocking on doors and phoning people and looking for illustration work was kind of terrifying. And I wasn't sure that I'd be able to make a living from my work. But very luckily, my parents kindly helped me out for a few months with my rent. And over that time, I knocked on lots of doors. And after many people saying, I like your work and I'll use you if I can, and me assuming that was a polite brush off, and in many cases it probably was, the work slowly, in the first year, I slowly picked up enough work that it began to feel like I could do this.
And were you working out of your flat, or did you?
No, Simone and I got a studio together with some other people in the old Truman Brewery on Brick Lane.
Oh yeah,
which was in a rather bad state of repair at the time. But I've always liked having a workplace to go to and to treat it like a job and lock up at the end of the day, and that's always helped focus me work-wise. So we found a studio and the rent was pretty cheap, and I was quite lucky. In the first year I stumbled into Time Out magazine and gave them some of my self-published comics, and they hired me to do a weekly cartoon for Time Out, which ran for about 2 years, which was called Move to the City, and wasn't a great success, and I don't think was perhaps brilliantly suited to Time Out, but it was a learning place for me to learn more about writing stories to a deadline, and it paid the rent, that weekly job. So that was a lucky break.
And so what sort of setup do you have now? You have your own studio that you go to every day, or do you still share with others?
I share with others. Until a couple of years ago, I was in quite a large studio with my agent, my illustration agent, Heart Agency, were there.
Yeah.
And some friends, I learned about the studio from my friend Marion Duchers, who had taught me at the Royal College of Art. So I was in a big communal studio there for, how long was I there for? Maybe 10 years.
Oh, wow.
And that had a nice feeling of the art school atmosphere. And then that building got redeveloped, as I guess studio buildings often do. And I'm now in a smaller studio with two friends, Jonathan Gray, who does book cover designs.
Oh, yes.
And Dan Mumford, who does posters and gig posters and album covers and things. So it's the three of us now. And I like that sociability of having people around to ask about things and to show work to, and to just feel the buzz of somebody else working alongside you.
I think what I wanted to ask you is how you approach a project. Do you see yourself now equally as much a writer as illustrator?
I think about that sometimes. I think probably still the balance is still loaded towards pictures.
When you're working on something, do you often have the words first, and that would trigger a visual response, or is it always a visual response that then you have to fit the words to?
Well, it can be either. And at other times, the idea comes as an idea in my brain, which is kind of neither words or pictures, or is both, or is an image with somebody talking. And of course, in order to get that down, you need to split it into words and pictures usually. So that's what's great about sketchbooks, is the ability to scribble down a note beside a drawing and to kind of work on those two things at the same time. So when I started out, I was definitely an illustrator who sometimes wrote a few words to put into the stories. But I'd say they're more, it's more balanced now.
Can you talk a little bit about how you create an illustration? I know that you have meticulous notebooks, but it would be interesting for listeners to understand how you go about getting from A to B, i.e., you know, the idea, the rough, and then the finished work.
Yes. Well, the idea is the biggest, it's the most important thing, and it's the hardest thing, and it's where all the problems come from. And because that's the first thing you have to do, that's the difficult part. There are some illustrators who can just draw something so beautifully that you could, it almost doesn't matter what they're drawing, it's always beautiful. But with my work, it's very much about a simple drawing expressing an idea. So the first thing I always do with any project is take out my sketchbook, and I will generally leave the studio and go for a walk, or at least before COVID-19, I would go for a walk and sit in a cafe and just try and fill pages of the sketchbook with thoughts about the cartoon or about the brief if it's an illustration job, and try not to rush to come up with an idea for a picture, but to come up with ideas about the concept. And the nice thing about being far away from my studio or my computer at that moment is I'm not sort of in a rush to make the finished version and send it off. I try and roll the idea around in my mind using the sketchbook for as long as I can before moving on to actually making a picture. So I'll fill as much sketchbook page as I can to try and come up with something. And then when I feel like I've got an idea, I'll go back to the studio and start working on drawings. Or if I haven't got an idea, I'll give up and come back to it another time. And at the studio then I'll draw generally with a pen or a pencil, just on photocopy paper, and try and turn those bits and bobs from the sketchbook, try and bring them together, thinking about the shape of the image, the size they've given me for the cartoon or the illustration size, and try and, through making lots of little thumbnails and lots of scribbles, try and squidge that idea into the box that I've been given for it.
I know that you work with, a rollerball pen, don't you?
Mm.
And you only like to work at the size that you find most convenient, relatively small, I guess, contained within on the page. And then you transfer that onto a light box. And
I use the light box a lot. You know, sometimes when you see a painter portrayed in a film, they have a kind of beautiful, you can't see me, but I'm kind of waving my arm around elegantly here.
Yes.
There's a kind of elegance. And I've seen artists who draw like that, and that's not me. It drawing something badly and tracing it and trying to make it a bit better and then tracing it again and rubbing this out, it's clunky. But I generally, after enough tracings and redrawings and changings, get it to the shape and size that I want it at. And I tend to draw, to answer your question about size, a little bit bigger than it's printed,
right,
but not so much bigger that it sort of loses the handmade feel.
Mm.
If you draw it really big and print it really tiny, it can look amazingly diamond precision feeling.
Yes.
But it's not what I want. I want the wobble of a line that I've tried to draw straight but hasn't quite worked out. And I like that. So I tend to draw just a little bit bigger than it'll be printed.
I think it's what the Japanese call the perfection is in the imperfection.
Yes.
Apart from working, have you worked with other writers very much, maybe early on?
I don't think I've ever collaborated directly with a writer. I've illustrated texts, but it's generally been commissioned by an editor, and I haven't. I may be forgetting something, but no.
I'm just wondering, because you use the term collaboration, that seems to be the buzzword over the last couple of years. Everyone's got to collaborate, it seems. And I always think of illustrators as kind of last bastion of self-contained people, you know, because it's your hand, it's your paper, it's your pen, it's your brain, and you're not collaborating at all. Now, I know that probably you have collaborated on some animation projects, and I just wondered how that process, how you enjoy or you don't enjoy that process, that idea of collaborating with another creative person that has an opinion.
Yeah, let me think. I haven't worked on many collaborative projects which haven't been very well struck. The animation projects I've done have been advertising work. So somebody on high is telling us what to do. So I am collaborating, but in a very sort of structured environment where you're sort of each doing your own part of the job, rather than what I see of truly collaborating, that kind of push and pull of working things out together. And I've done very little of that over my career. And I like the idea of it, but I also suspect I haven't got very many skills for doing that.
It's the only collaborations I've ever experienced is working on the rare occasions that I've done advertising, and I've worked with, you know, the copywriter, art director couple kind of thing. And I found that exhilarating because you're working in a different area and it becomes very much a two-way thing. You suddenly find halfway through you're exchanging thoughts. The writer will start to suggest imagery and you might start suggesting words. It's a rather nice thing. And I can see if I never worked in advertising as such, but I think, you know, on reflection now, perhaps in a previous life, I would have enjoyed it because good copyright. I love good copywriters. I hate because their currency is words, and every word is important with a really good copywriter. You know, they write beautifully and they're very concise, and it's usually in very simple conversational style, and I have always loved that.
Yeah, and I think having someone to bounce ideas off can be a very useful thing. And I'm slightly jealous sometimes of people I know who write, especially write comedy, with a partner.
Yeah.
And having somebody else to ask if this is funny, who knows it well enough to give you the right answer and help you. I sometimes struggle with that. I'm looking at a cartoon of mine and I'm trying to figure out if it's funny. And I know as soon as I say to somebody, is this funny? They're so tense about answering the question that it's like an observer destroying the experiment sort of thing. So I've sort of learned to just trust my own judgment. And if sometimes they turn out to be too weird and not funny, that's the downside. But I imagine in a writing partnership that negates some of that terrific fear that you've just written an absolute stinker.
I think the ultimate sort of collaboration, which is such a joy, is musical collaboration. And thinking of Scotland, do you know those programs, Transatlantic? I think they're called Transatlantic Exchanges, where people from America in like the bluegrass area or wherever that played fiddles would come to Scotland. They'd go to a particular place and there's a very famous fiddle player, Scottish fiddle player, that was the host. And he'd get the most amazing people over. And they would be, you know, they'd be different ages. They would be from different backgrounds. Once they were in the room and they started playing together, it was like magic. It was like a family suddenly for those moments that they were performing. And I just envy that sort of thing.
It must be so
wonderful.
Well, both my daughters are musicians and I watch them playing with friends. And having this making art in such a friendly, lively way. And sometimes I do think, well, it's a pity that my way of making art involves quietly going away on my own to a room to do it, rather than this sort of lovely, friendly thing. But actually, I think it probably suits my personality better to scamper away to the room on my own.
And I don't think with your work, collaborating would, apart from the occasional suggestion, I don't think it would. The fact is, it's your work. It's like a solo musician, cellist or something. Ultimately, you're listening to that cellist. Okay, there's a lot of people surrounding them, but that's just to, you know, come in at the right moments. But really, it's about them. So I think you're more like you are a solo practitioner.
Yeah, and as we were sort of started talking about, the nice thing with a book project is I work on it on my own, and then right at the end, when I take it to the publisher, there's suddenly talented, enthusiastic people making suggestions. Mm. Just at the point when I'm slightly exhausted with the whole project, there's a designer saying, well, I like what your cover design is here, but how about we do X, Y, or Z? And that enthusiasm and also an editor who can sort of tweak a few things that you've kind of slightly glossed over on after looking at them for a million times is a really nice part of the project.
You have I was looking at your website the other day, and it's incredibly well ordered. You're selling, you can get your books via your website, you can buy prints, posters. So you've set it up very well. So that, I assume, and it's a great publicity machine for you. So I'm just wondering, how do you see your future?
Well,
do you ever think of your future?
I do sometimes. I mean, I'd the nice thing about doing the weekly cartoons for The Guardian, particularly, is that feeling of, you know, I've been doing it for 15 years now. And I like that idea that there's this sort of vein of my cartoons running through the newspaper for all that time. And I'd love to keep doing those weekly cartoons in some form or other for as long as me or the Guardian are still around. So that side of my work of making the cartoons, I can't imagine stopping doing that. But for example, this last year when I've written a children's book for the first time, felt really nice that it was using a lot of the skills I've learned, but it was pushing them into a new area and trying new things. It's not hugely different. I'm quite a cautious person, but it felt like I've sort of taken over a new little bit of land in the kind of map of what I can do. So that feels good. And I think I'd like to do not to kind of start afresh or unveil some new style, but I guess just keep trying to push things in one direction or other.
Well, I look forward to that. We've come to the end now, but I always ask this question. What advice would you give to a budding Tom or Tessa wanting to follow in your footsteps?
Well, I remember when I was starting out as an illustrator, I'd call up newspapers and magazines and things and I'd want them to hire me to make an illustration or a cartoon. And I was always frightened that they'd be terribly annoyed with me for bothering them when they were busy making a magazine or whatever. And over the years, I've realised that of course they wouldn't be annoyed. That this is what the world needs people to do these things. And I was for years quite frightened of putting myself forward and suggesting things to people. But I'm probably still a bit cautious about things like that. But it's just to realise that the world needs you to make these silly bits of art which you sit at home doing, and you shouldn't be embarrassed about that. And almost they need you more than you need them. So that's one thing I've come to realise.
Well, I think in this period that we're going through, this pandemic, people certainly need you. Tom Gould, thank you very much for sharing your RDI insights.
Thanks, Mike, and thanks for all your thoughtful questions.
If you have enjoyed this podcast, there are a further 49 available featuring royal designers from many disciplines, talking about their life and work. Just type RDI Insights-RSA into your browser and you'll find them. Thank you for listening.